Welcome to Close Up Radio, where our hosts, Doug Llewellyn and Jim Masters, bring you the amazing stories of people who answered the call to unlock their potential and taken control of their own success with authenticity, creativity, persistence, and resilience. Close Up Radio special guests share their knowledge and wisdom so you, the listener, can live the most empowered life possible. Close Up Radio. And now, here's today's host, Doug Llewellyn.
Well, thank you so much. Hi, folks. I'm Doug Llewellyn. Nice to be back here with you today. And I'm also excited because Tom Glenn is back with us. Tom has been a guest previously on these broadcasts, and he is an amazing man. He's an amazing author who has written numerous books, and we're going to be talking about a number of those books today. Many of them are reflecting a lot of his experiences when he was in service for the Army and the military in Vietnam. He is a Vietnam vet who's had a number of careers, including an intelligence operative. That's another word for spy, which he was. And he has some chilling stories to talk about that aspect of his background. And one of the reasons I think that he was so sought after to become a spy is because he was a linguist, or let's put it this way, the Army, the military, made him a linguist in 7 different languages. He's very adept at learning languages. He ended up being able to speak 7 languages after going to the language school in the military. Amazing. He's a musician, by the way, a cryptologist. He is now a caregiver for the dying. He is a leadership coach. And he has an amazing background, a BA in music, a master's in government, and a doctorate in public administration. To say the least, he's a sought-after public speaker and the author of an amazing series of books, and we're going to be speaking about them. Let me just preface this a little bit. You know, throughout history, we have shamelessly glorified war in the name of profit, propaganda, and mindless entertainment, when in fact, war is one of our greatest failures. Tom speaks about that a lot. He says, and he writes about how barbaric war is, how gratuitous, unjust, debasing war has been, and how it has cost the U.S. millions of innocent lives. He also points out that Hollywood box office success movies about war, movies like Saving Private Ryan, Platoon, and We Were Soldiers, there's another one that we have to add to that list, and that would be Apocalypse Now. We're all praised for depicting the real terror of combat, but he says for the most part, those movies fell short with factual inaccuracies, and they actually toned down the grittiness of the horrific reality of what it's actually like to be in a war zone. That's what he has focused a lot on with his books, to try and describe what war really is like and how awful it can be. So anyway, we're going to talk to Tom today. It's a real treat to bring him back on the line with us. I love hearing his stories, and you know he is in the later point in life, he always knew he wanted to write, and now that he's no longer serving as a spy in the military and some of the other jobs as he's had, he has the time to write, and he is turning out numerous books. So Tom Glenn, welcome back. Tom lives in Columbia, Maryland, between Baltimore and Washington, and it's a delight to have you back with us. How are you today, Tom? Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Doug. I'm doing beautifully. How about yourself?
I'm doing good, and as I said before, I look forward to chatting with you because you have such, you know, you're so great with your points about the stories you write and what you write about war. I was just talking about how movies kind of glorify war, and I was thinking about, you know, you were in Vietnam. You went through Vietnam, the fall of Vietnam, the fall of Saigon.
Oh, yes.
When Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola, made Apocalypse Now, it was said to be really, really accurate. What's your response to that? Do you think, I'm sure you saw the movie, right? What did you think about it?
Long ago, but let me correct one other thing. When I was in Vietnam, the whole time I was there, I was a civilian. I was operating undercover as military, but I wasn't military. I was undercover as an enlisted man in whatever unit I was supporting on the battlefield. So part of the hilarious part of my story is that although I've spent more time in combat than anybody I know, I did it all as a civilian, undercover as military. So there's that.
That means, I mean, you were a spy, right? We've talked about that. That's SPY,
yeah.
comes in there, right? Okay, all right.
I was a spy in the sense that what I was doing was I was intercepting and exploiting the radio communications of the enemy, and using that information to tip off troops on the battlefield. Look out! There they are. Here they come. Here's what they plan to do. Here's who they are. Here's what their strength is, and so on. And when people would listen to me, I was very, very successful. Turns out, with the Marine Corps, they always listened to me very carefully and exploited my information and had some great victories as a result. But there were times with the Army when they didn't listen to me. Turns out, I found out much later, that many of the Army commanders were not trained to know what signals intelligence was. They'd never heard of it. All they knew was here was this civilian parading around as if he were one of them, telling him, look out, the enemy's over there, here's what he's going to do. And they said, who the hell are you? Get out of here. And there were times they didn't listen. Most famously, I think, in the 1967 Battle of Dok Tho in the Central Highlands of Vietnam, when record numbers of people were killed on both sides, and yet, at the very end of the battle, no territory had changed hands.
Wow. Explain being a civilian, and you were obviously in Saigon. How did you get access to, you know, the military commanders who you were you know, giving tips on what they should pay attention to? Why would they listen to a civilian? What was your position?
Well, as I say, the Marine Corps were trained. They knew what signals intelligence was, and part of the reason for that was that one of their early commanders was a man who had spent part of his early career in the Marine Corps as a signals intelligence specialist, and that was Al Gray. He went on to become, well, when I first met him, he was a captain, and he and I kept running into each other all over Vietnam. He was commanding troops. I was doing signals intelligence. He was the guy who got me out of Saigon alive in April 1975. He showed up at my door one day. At that point, he was a colonel, but he was undercover as a civilian. And he saw to it that I got out of there alive at the very end, and I escaped under fire. Now, when you talk about Apocalypse Now, it's been so long since I've seen it, I don't remember anymore, but I have never seen a movie that approaches the savagery and the ugliness of combat and how awful it is. There's nothing quite like the guy that right next to you, this man that who's, you'd give up your life to save, and he gave up his life to save you. He's killed, and what's left of him is splattered all over you, and then there's not enough of him, of his body to be able to be gathered and put into a body bag. It's that kind of horror.
Wow. Well, you know, you have written about it. I want to talk about your books. We've talked about your experiences in Vietnam in some of our previous broadcasts. But I want to go down the list of some of the books. For example, the first one you wrote called Friendly Casualties was really based and centered on the Tet Offensive in Vietnam back in 1968.
Yes.
Talk to me a little bit about that. And when did you write this book, by the way? I assume it's after you came back. You were out of the service by that point. Am I right?
No, I had been writing since I was 6 years old, and I was writing all through my years, but when I was still working for the government, I never had time to write very much because they kept sending me all over the world to spy. So much of the writing was done after I got out of after I retired, which was 30 years ago. And in other cases where I had already written the book, I was going back and revising and all that sort of thing. So I wrote that book. It was one of my early ones, and my guess is I wrote it probably when I was in my 40s or thereabouts, while I was still working for the government.
Well, let's talk about it. These are all great books, by the way. I mean, your writing is extraordinary. Tell me this: what Friendly Casualties is really all about? It's a novel in short in stories, right?
Not quite. It's the only book of its kind I've ever come across. That is, the first half of it are all short stories. Most of them set in Vietnam about the war, about things that were happening. The second half of it is a novella, which is set in Vietnam, and it's the story of a woman working for the American embassy and the man she's in love with, who was an army captain working on the battlefield, and he is killed at the end. So she has to come to terms with the horrors of war herself. Does that tell you what you need to know?
It does. I mean, it goes into a lot of things, but it's an amazing book. It's still available. All of these books are, if you look on your blog, you have a great blog. It's not a website, it's a blog. But the blog is Tom Glenn, GLENN.blog. You will open up your blog on the internet, which really goes into great detail on the books and what they're about, and explains how to get them through your blog. And that was the first one. There were stories from Vietnam, book number one. After that one, where did you, what did you turn to next?
Are you still there?
I'm right here. Yeah, I was saying,
okay.
What did you turn to next after Friendly Casualties? Cause
the next book to come out was New Accounts, and that was quite a departure. What happened was that in the mid and early 1980s, after I was back from Vietnam, I was suffering from post-traumatic stress injury, something awful. I was having flashbacks and panic attacks and all kinds of stuff. I learned that there were two things I could do to help me get through that. One was to focus on the memories, force myself to bring these unspeakable memories into my conscious mind, learn to live with them without getting hysterical. The other thing that was most helpful was helping other people. So I found out that when I was taking care of people who needed my help, my memories faded into the background because I was so focused on these people who needed me. As a result of that, again, in the 1980s, I started reading in the newspaper about how men were dying on the street of AIDS because nobody would touch them or go near them. And I couldn't tolerate that. And I said to my wife, I've got to volunteer to help these guys. I just can't stand this. But I said to her, if I do, there's some chance I'll get AIDS because we don't know how it's transmitted. And the other thing is, if I get it, you'll get it, and it's fatal. She said, go do it. So I did. We did eventually find out that AIDS was transmitted by bodily fluid. And so I was never in danger, although at one point I did stick myself with a needle after I had given a shot to one of my patients. But fortunately, nothing happened. I did not get the disease. Well, I spent 5 years taking care of guys dying of AIDS. There were seven of them. They were all gay. They all died. And I was so moved with that experience that I wrote a novel about it, one of my few books that's not about war or Vietnam, and that's Friendly Casualties. It's the story of a straight man taking care of a gay man dying of AIDS and what happens between them. And is true with all of my books. Everything in that book, even though it's fiction, are things that really did happen. I attributed the actions to people other than myself or the people I knew, which makes it fiction. But the stories themselves are real. So that's where that book comes from.
You know, I can't help but want to ask you a question. You went to college. I mean, you're highly educated, but your original thoughts obviously had to deal with music. You got a BA in music.
Yes.
Whatever happened to that? Did you ever make use of that degree that you got?
Yes, I did. I wrote reams of music, primarily for church groups who were performing it. I ran folk groups, little groups with a small number of instruments. I played them.
Right.
I taught myself to play the guitar so I could do that. I wrote all kinds of arrangements for them. We had instruments like oboe and flute and clarinet that played with us. And then I wrote masses for combined choir and folk group. And all of that was, I've still got all the manuscripts from that, and all the music was performed. But the reason I got into music was because I didn't want to be a writer. I found out when I was 6 years old I was born to write, and I fought that in various ways. And one of the ways I fought it was trying to become a musician. But I soon discovered that no matter how hard I tried to get away from that fate, I was stuck with it. I was going to be a writer, and that was all there was to it. So I finally gave up music and went back to writing.
Wow. It's interesting knowing what you've done and what your output as a writer, But there's never much mention of a career toward music. And yet, originally, I think that's what you thought you might want to do. So it just shows how people change their minds, you know, after they go to college and focus on one aspect of a career, and they end up doing something totally different. But then the military kind of changed your aspect, too. I know that they're the ones, when you went in the military, they're the ones who sent you to language school to learn how to speak all these different languages that you became so adept at, right?
Well, that's partly true. Here's the story behind that. This was 1957, if I remember right. The draft was in effect. I had a college deference as long as I was in school, but after I graduated, I knew I was about to be drafted. So instead of being drafted, I volunteered for the Army with a proviso that I would go to the language school at Monterey, California, Defense Language Institute, to study Chinese. But when I got to the DLI, they told me they weren't going to teach me Chinese. They were going to teach me a thing called Vietnamese language I had never heard of back in 1957. I had no choice. I was in the Army. I had to follow orders. So I went in for a full year's intensive study of Vietnamese, 6 hours a day in the classroom, 2 hours private study every night, 5 days a week, for 52 weeks. When I graduated, first in my class, in a class of 10 people, I said to the Army, now send me to Vietnam. They said no. They have nothing going on in Vietnam. Instead, they sent me to a place I'd never heard of, the National Security Agency, NSA. When I got there, I found out that Georgetown University offered classes in Chinese, and I was still determined to learn Chinese. And I should mention, I knew the Chinese was too difficult. I couldn't teach it to myself. I was going to have to learn it in the school. So I went to Georgetown. I became a part-time graduate student, went to classes at night to study Chinese. So by the time my enlistment in the Army was over, I was comfortable in Vietnamese, Chinese, and French, the three languages of Vietnam.
Wow.
And I ended my enlistment. NSA hired me and immediately sent me to Vietnam for the first time in 1962. The only language that the military ever taught me was Vietnamese. All the others I learned either by myself or in various language schools at various places because I wanted to know what these languages were. I taught myself French and Italian as a child. I took 4 years of Latin in high school. Then in college, I studied German, among other things. And the other languages, I went to our local junior college to study Spanish. This was just a few years ago when I realized it was the most commonly spoken foreign language in the United States, and I didn't know it. So I thought, I better fix that. So I went and took classes and got so I could speak Spanish.
Good
so that's
for
the
you.
Story of my, that's where my, all my languages come from.
Well, and then, by the way, have you made use of that ability to learn all these languages? Did you ever have you know, occasion to use the various languages, like French and German and others that you learned?
Yes, but I can't tell you about it. after 1975, after the fall of Saigon, I had proven that I was extremely good at working on the battlefield, using my languages to gain information about the enemy.
Right.
The National Security Agency proceeded to send me other places around the world to go on doing that kind of work. And I spent a good many years doing that. I can't tell you where I went, who I worked with, or what I did, because it's all still classified.
I find that amazing. It's been so long. How long does, you know, information like that stay classified? If it were, you know, if what you're talking about, if that came out today, would that have some kind of an impact that could be detrimental to the United States? What do you think?
I don't know the answer to that question. I can tell you that my time in Vietnam and what I did there was classified until 2016, I guess it was. Then it was declassified. So it's something like some 40-odd years after the fact, if it won't be harmful, it can be declassified. So one of these years, I suppose, I'll get word that my time in other countries has been classified. I could talk about that, where I was and what I did. Suffice it to say, I was all over the world.
What a career. Amazing.
Yeah.
Let's get back to the books. Let's get back to the book. After Sitocracy, that's it. hard to pronounce. You wrote a bunch of stories, you know, a cluster of stories called Coming to Terms.
Yes.
Which sounds really interesting. Tell me a little bit about that.
almost everything I write about is people facing very tough situations in their lives and trying to decide what to do about them.
Yeah.
Coming to Terms is a series of stories about people doing precisely that. All kinds of people doing all kinds of things. Sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. But that's what Coming to Terms is all about. It's all stories about people struggling with challenges in their lives that threaten them and how they resolve them.
It sounds very, very interesting. Then,
well, thank you.
And then we come to The Last of the Enemies, which a major book you wrote on what war is really like. Tell
yeah.
me a little bit about it. We've talked about it before, but let's go
sure.
into it again.
Okay.
Go ahead.
It's the story. It's set during the fall of Saigon. And again, everything in that book, that every event described really did happen. But it does not tell my story, because my story was classified when I wrote the book. And instead, I wrote about a retired Marine officer whose son had died in Vietnam. And after that, as a civilian, he returns to Vietnam right at the end to work to save the country. He can't stand the idea that his son died in a war that we were then going to lose. So he does everything he can to help us win that war. And, of course, he doesn't succeed. We do lose the war. And the book focuses on little boys, because, first of all, it's talking about his son, whom he remembers as a little boy. And the very opening scene is when he's in Da Nang at an orphanage with a little child who's dying. And it describes the death of that child and how that cements his decision that he's going to do more. So that's what the whole book is about. And it's, as I say, everything in it really did happen. It tells the story of what happened. Well, it does not tell my story. And very briefly, my story was that I was the head of this clandestine operation run by NSA in South Vietnam. I had 43 guys working for me. Some of them had their families living in Vietnam, because at that point in time, we had declared that the war was over. We had signed a peace treaty with the North Vietnamese, and it was considered a gentleman's tour. It was no longer a wartime tour. So I was able to bring my family over there at the very end. And I knew early on that the North Vietnamese were getting closer and closer to Saigon. They had eventually conquered the whole country except for Saigon. They had Saigon surrounded, and it was a question of time until they attacked the city. I warned the ambassador of that. He didn't believe me. The White House in Washington, D.C. didn't believe me. And U.S. policy was that the war was over and nothing was going to happen. Well, I had 43 guys working for me and their families. I had to get them out of there. So I lied and I stealed and I stole or cheated, do anything I had to do to get those people out of there safely. I did get them all out at the very last day when the North Vietnamese were already in the streets of the city. I got my last two guys out, a communicator and a communication technician who had been keeping me in touch with NSA and other places. And then 8 o'clock that night on the 29th of April 1975, I went out under fire on a helicopter to the 7th Fleet, U.S. 7th Fleet, that was cruising out in the South China Sea. And took me a very long time to recover from that, because I was very sick from all kinds of problems. I had pneumonia, I had dysentery, exhaustion, and severe ear damage as a result of the shelling that we were caught in, that kind of stuff. But eventually
wow.
I did recover and got back on my feet, and here I am today.
That was all about the fall of Saigon, and that was a rare time. And you did get – the guys you got out, by the way, were they South Vietnamese who were working, you know, for the Americans, or were they Americans who, you know, civilians and others like that, who, when you call them your guys, who were –
No, my guys were all Americans.
They were.
We did have
okay.
with us a whole bunch of – we had almost 3,000 South Vietnamese working with us on
right.
intercepting and exploiting the communications of the North Vietnamese. I tried
right.
and tried and tried to get those people evacuated, and I failed. They were all there at the very end. The North Vietnamese killed most of them on the spot. And those who survived were sent to concentration camps. Yeah, that's one of the great.
Sounds somewhat similar to the exit from Afghanistan, doesn't it? A little bit.
Yes, it does. And when it happened in Afghanistan, I could think of this reminded me so much of Vietnam and what had happened there.
Wow. No kidding. You talk about war. You know, I'm sure you turn on the television and you see what's going on in Ukraine and what, you know, the Russians are doing to that country. It must bring back pretty uncomfortable memories for you.
Yes, it does.
What do you think about that?
Well, first of all,
that for a moment.
Yeah, first of all, let me get one thing straight. I don't watch television. I have never watched television because I never have time. I'm reading. I have to read constantly as a writer, and I review books and so on and so on. But nevertheless, I do listen to the radio, and I certainly read the newspaper, the Washington Post and the New York Times. And the stories of what's going on in Ukraine remind me so much of what happened in Vietnam. And my own forecast about what's going to happen in Ukraine is the Russians will eventually conquer the country, but guerrilla warfare will go on. The Ukrainians will never give in. And after a certain number of years, I don't know how many, the Russians will finally say, that's enough of that. Let's get out of here. And they'll quit and leave, just like we quit and left Vietnam.
Wow. Let's get back to the books. You also have another book that has a very interesting title called The Tryon. I assume I'm pronouncing that right. The Tryon Syndrome. Am I right? What's that about?
That's my only book about post-traumatic stress injury. But I wrote it to help me cope with it. It's the story of a man who is a German professor. And he had been in Vietnam, and he doesn't remember what happened. All he knows is that he has nightmares. He has flashbacks. He has all kinds of terrible problems. He has never heard of post-traumatic stress injury, and that term is never mentioned in the book. But one day he realizes, he remembers what did happen. He killed a child. And that upsets him so much that he quits his job. He goes off to Maine to live as a bum up there. And at one point tries to commit suicide, but he fails. He tries to drown himself, but his instincts take over, and he saves himself. I don't want to give away what happens that helps him finally find the way to solve his problem. But I'll tell you this much. One day, a young man shows up at his door and says he's there to help. And that's all I'll tell you about how the book ends.
Well, I think I should point out that you have written with a lot of knowledge about this because you yourself suffered from post-traumatic stress injury, right? Pretty seriously.
Oh, yes. Oh, absolutely.
Right?
Still do, always will. It's a disease that never goes away. What you have to learn to do is to cope with it. And, as I said before, to find ways to help other people. When you're helping other people, all those memories fade into the background. So that's what I do.
Wow. Well, I must tell you, I love chatting with you, Tom, because your stories are so amazing, and you know, what you write about is what you experienced. From what you're writing, very, very knowledgeable. I want to point out, you know, we're almost out of time today, but Tom is going to be back again with us next week, same time, same station, so to speak, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll continue this conversation about Tom's experiences and his books. By the way, if you're interested, and you should be, go look at his blog on the Internet. It's Tom Glenn, Glenn, .blog. Go there. There's all kinds of information on the books and on Tom's experiences in Vietnam and in the war. It was something else, and Tom's extraordinary ability to write about it is just wonderful. So, Tom, thank you so much for being with us again. I look forward to welcoming you back next week, same time, okay?
Thank you so much, Doug.
Oh, listen, it's great to have you here. Thank you for your time and your story, because they're always great to hear. So that'll do it for this edition, everybody. I'm Doug Llewellyn. We'll look forward to having you back again with Tom next week, same time. Be with us, okay? Bye now.
You have been listening to a broadcast from Close Up Radio, a division of Close Up Television, Incorporated. For more information about our show and to be considered for future broadcasts, please visit closeuptelevision.com. You may also learn about us on social media and listen to us on podcast and internet radio. Thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have an empowered and productive day.